But in the process, I knew that I deeply valued autonomy and I wanted to build something of my own. So that just really clearly pointed me in the direction of going solo.
Hey, friend. It's David Nabinsky here in Brooklyn. Here at the Portfolio Career Podcast, we help you take ownership of your portfolio career and design the life that you want to live. Today's conversation is with Simon Rodriguez. We met through the Chief of Staff Network, where I work. To learn more, check out chiefofstaff.network. In this episode with Simon, you'll learn about the benefits and the details and nuances of a Chief of Staff role, how Simon got his prior and most recent Chief of Staff role, leaving his Chief of Staff role, what he's been up to now, including launching his newsletter called Technopoly, and the benefits of working on a newsletter while building out his portfolio and working on other things. So if you're interested in Chief of Staff work and career transitions, this episode is for you. As always, this episode with timestamp notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. There, you can subscribe to my newsletter called One Email Away, which has the best insights from the podcast and friend-sourced job opportunities. So excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Here we go with Simon. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you like about writing a newsletter?
Good question. More than one thing. There are things I don't like, but I like more than I don't like. What I like about writing a newsletter is closely related to what I like about writing, which is writing as a practice is fundamentally an exercise in clear thinking. So writing the newsletter for me is just this big reason each week to sit down, read something new, and not just let it go kind of glaze across my eyes, but to, you know, I'm not here writing some sort of revolutionary tome about what's happening on tech in BC and Latin America, but there is a small critical spin. There is some quantitative analysis, and I love that I get to go and digest something and sharpen my thinking. And now that I've been at it for a few months now, it's one of the most tangible ways to see how my knowledge is accreting. Now, I don't pretend to be the expert on my subject area in this area, and I'm very open that it's an exercise in building in public. But I think that's probably the best part, which is being able to look back and say in a very tangible way, it's a digital product, but in a very tangible way, there's this body of work that I'm building. And as I go, I get to provide everyone a service and I get to learn. And I also just enjoy writing. It's writing a newsletter in the way that I do. It's mostly, you know, curation, news, analysis. It's not the most creative flair. I'm not Shakespeare. I'm not a novelist. But there is some creativity to it, whether it's just dropping a small pun in there or even just trying to connect a couple disparate data points in someone's mind that may not always do. I think a good example is one of the newsletters that I wrote. I think it came out last week, actually, or in the last couple of weeks, just looking at correlations between socioeconomic inequality and venture capital investment levels. Is there a relationship between the two? How does it impact them? Something like inequality is something that I care about in a very abstract sense, and kind of even removing politics, I think a lot of people have some sort of skin in that game. And VC is what I write about. So to be able to connect something that isn't going to show up in every A16Z think piece was fun. And then to apply it to Latin America, and there's this really hungry audience that I'm new, but I'm starting to connect with an entirely new set of leaders, thought makers, investors, founders, builders, and just observers. So to summarize what was maybe circuitous, I love the process for me, and I'm happy that there's positive benefit to an audience that seems to be hungry for it. So if I can do something that's great for me and great for them and enjoy the process of it, happy days.
Yeah. Yeah. And it probably has been helpful as part of kind of your, and we'll get into a kind of transition from kind of more corporate chief of staff life into portfolio life, right? I can imagine, you know, as part of like the transition saying, hey, I now got this new thing. Like as you're transitioning, you're also like, as you said, kind of that part about like positive momentum, positive compounding knowledge, but also just like momentum. So I think that that's, I really like how, you know, as part of like the transition, because I know like sometimes, let's say you're changing, like looking for a job, you're oftentimes like feel like you're kind of more reactive, right? You then are like, oh, I'm just going to put out, you know, apply to 10 jobs. I'm going to send, you know, and it's a lot. And then as opposed to this is like, hey, I'm transitioning, or and also like I'm now just starting from a new spot and I'm like building upon this.
I definitely agree. The main reason that I decided to go solo, freelance, portfolio, career, whatever you want to call it, was for the autonomy and to build something. It was really nice when I made that transition. And frankly, when, you know, I was calling it fractional chief of staff, or I was calling it whatever, trying to explain this weird hybrid of strategy, operations, and content that I was doing, it was nice to be able to try to explain to my mom or to somebody not in the scene, oh, and I also write a newsletter about technology and startups and venture capital in Latin America. That was at least a nice tangible thing that people could sink their teeth into. So it wasn't just, oh yeah, he's off on his own and doesn't know what's happening. But I totally agree. The momentum has been huge. Every week, for better or for worse, it's the anchor to my week. My girlfriend will probably tell you that it's annoying that a lot of times it bleeds into the weekend and Sunday becomes the anchor point to edit and send it out. But it is quite nice to have that feeling on Monday morning of the newsletter going out. It shows up in my inbox just like everyone else's, and then just start seeing the engagement numbers, and to every so often look back and look at the body and say, yep, okay, one more branch in the bunch, onwards and upwards.
We'll talk about the transition a little bit more, but I'm curious as to, I want to talk about kind of the chief of staff world, a place where we have a common point of connection. But do you think some of your chief of staff work helped you write the newsletter, i.e. the skills that you're developing, whether that's kind of internal comms or memos or things like that, made it kind of easier to write a newsletter, so that maybe to the person that's, you know, a chief of staff that's out there that's like, hey, that looks cool, but like, I don't know if I can do it.
Completely. There's a, in that book, The Generalist, I'm blanking on the author's name, about defending generalists. He talks a lot about the Tiger Woods versus Roger Federer model of growth and expertise, right? For those who don't know, Tiger Woods started playing golf since before he could walk, basically, and only ever played golf and became the best, but only ever played golf. And then other things happened, but until then, he only played golf. Roger Federer, until the age of about 14, played pretty much every sport. You know, he was an athlete first, tennis second, and then became the greatest tennis player of all time, debatably, but with the most grand slams as of September 12th, 2022. Touch wood to see if it stays the same. But I would say that being a chief of staff was very much the Roger Federer training for my career. And that applies to the newsletter, and it applies to pretty much everything else that I do. Being a chief of staff is all of these IQ and EQ skills rolled into one, from quant analytics to qualitative analysis to internal communications, external communications, to thorough proofreading, to storytelling. It's tough to narrow down one thing, because if you're a good chief of staff, I would say your job, regardless of what the day-to-day is to make somebody else or many other people into superheroes. And that requires a bit of a jujitsu mentality of being water. I think it's one of the metaphors that I've liked, and being water means being flexible, being someone's Swiss Army knife. So I don't think I'd be as good from a skills standpoint at the newsletter without the chief of staff job. I could have gone straight into writing. That would have helped, obviously, but barring going straight into a writing career, it helps quite a bit. And from a content and domain expertise standpoint, yeah, if it was being a chief of staff that gave me the insight to a lot of the problems and decisions that founders were having, gave my insight into the investment process in terms of venture capital, a lot of the challenges in growing and scaling an organization, or even a sectoral view, if you want to go and think about the chief of staff doing market research and analysis and then just applying that to a newsletter. So from both a kind of form and function side, yeah, being a chief of staff was great for it. Obviously, as I say, yeah, if I had a journalistic background, that would have been the straightest route between A and B. But like I mean, Federer didn't take the straight route. He took the long route, and I'm definitely a bit more Fed than I am Tiger.
I love the analogies. And tennis is also timely too, considering the US Open was this weekend and has been going on for the last couple of weeks. Okay, so you mentioned how chief of staff has been kind of a launch pad to kind of where you are now. With Curio, I think sometimes like
people are kind of curious about how to get a chief of staff role. So maybe we can just talk about that, because I think you and I both know the benefits to the role and how it, you know, is a launch pad to what you're up to now. But for someone that's maybe looking for a chief of staff role, I think with Curio, you were maybe like a user of the product before joining. Maybe talk to us a little bit about that process or that journey, if that's true.
Yeah, definitely. I was a light user of the product, but I think from a macro standpoint, there's kind of two ways that you can get a job, right? You can apply to an existing vacancy or you can create the vacancy. In this case, I'm going to undermine my own framework. I actually did a little bit of both. Curio was hiring for a head of operations at the time, and I interviewed for the role, did the first round interview, had been recruited for it. And after the first round, started having a discussion with them about what their needs were and kind of flipped the interview framework. Instead of them just asking the questions, I was trying to dig a bit deeper. And we came to the conclusion that the needs were broader than just the head of operations role, and they wanted someone to be more flexible to basically act as their, as the, now I say they, I mean my two co-founders, Govan and Srikant. They wanted someone who's going to be more flexible at the leadership level to be a bit more of their shadow and to be their amplifier and to be their anchor. And so there was already a, like, let's call it 90% of the need. And then that 10% margin was what we negotiated to say, hey, it's not this, it's the chief of staff role. So I was lucky in the sense there was an existing vacancy and loads of folks will be able to go and look for those. It may be tough if it's your first gig, say, if you're looking to become a tech chief of staff, it may be challenging to create a vacancy as your first job because it's so network driven. But my overall advice to anyone who's looking for this role is to be curious and talk to interesting businesses. That's pretty good life advice, I would say, is you'll probably end up more fulfilled if you do that. But whether it was for the chief of staff role, even afterwards as a portfolio career, it's fine to be upfront. It's good to be upfront, say that you're looking for a job, but it's also great whether you're not actively looking or whether you are looking, but just don't want to come across as desperate, just to ask about what's on, what other people's needs are. And if there's a company that you find interesting, send the cold email, ask them what they need, where they're at, build connection, build weak connections if maybe, and follow up. You'd be surprised how many people don't do the simple thing and follow up. If you say, they reach out and say, hey, I'm interested. And you say, well, great, apply for this role or talk to this person. They just drop the ball. So it doesn't, I don't think the process of trying to network and build connections is complex. It's quite simple. It's just a matter of applied effort. It's not always going to work out. There will be rejection, but whether you're applying to an existing vacancy like I was, or you're trying to sort of feel out the ecosystem, just go and ask questions. And if you show that initiative, then you will certainly land on your feet, because any startup leader is going to be looking for someone who shows initiative and engagement, especially early days when you need a lot of generalists who are just going to show up and be willing to put in the hours.
And can you share a little bit more about that 10%? You said that there was the head of operations and then there was like the 10% that you kind of, what were you kind of really seeking there?
Absolutely. So there are risks to different titles, especially in an early stage startup, no matter what, right? You're going to be wearing a number of hats, and there's always a Venn diagram between what your job description is and what you actually do. And they're never completely coincident, right? So getting that out of the way and saying that there are risks to having a chief of staff role, which we can also talk about. But when I came in and was talking to them about the needs, the risk that I identified was if I come in and say I'm head of operations, this was a marketing and product led company, I was concerned that I would be left to be the kind of guy carrying the clipboard, following everyone around after their meetings, taking their notes and sending next steps and summaries, which is an important part of what I did. But as I spoke with them, I realized, hang on, one of the critical needs that they had was to set up a functional leadership team, because there was no middle management layer when I came in, that had new ways of working, new cultural norms, and could meet everyone where they were at. And the title chief of staff linked me in two ways. One, the chief linked me closer to the CEO and the COO who I reported to, which gave me an element of leaning on their authority. And the staff bit emphasized the fact that this was going to have a big people element. It wasn't just the guy who was going to be setting up, you know, Zapier integrations or implementing OKRs, which again, things that I did and could do, but it wasn't only that. So being chief of staff allowed me to basically come in and say, I have a lot more flexibility. We'll set the role based on my precedent, but it gives me more latitude to come in and do what you guys need me to do. And if you need me to come in and work with the executive team to implement a new way of working, well, having that chief title is going to prime them in a different way than just being the operations person. It allowed me to be leading as opposed to sort of reactive. And then that then translated into a way that we did internal communications, the way that we facilitated all of our management meetings and strategy offsites. It also gave me more cachet in the boardroom, even though I was just, you know, taking notes and preparing materials and had some voice, but obviously a backseat. Most of what I did for the board was before and after meetings. It's a little bit more, makes a bit more sense to your investors when you have your chief of staff sitting in the meeting than your head of operations. And the board, for example, was a big element of what I ended up supporting on. So for many ways, it gave everyone a lot more latitude to execute what needed to get done, particularly when it came to leadership and influence, which is something that I think a COO can do by virtue of having this big C in their name. But a head of operations might be a little bit more hamstrung, just given the wording.
Yeah. Big C. You mentioned a little bit about this idea of like there's risks to the role. Are you able to share a little bit more about that? I mean, it obviously is a an appealing role for many reasons. But yeah, what do you think is like one risk to the role?
Yeah. The challenge with the chief of staff role is probably what many people listening know already, which is nobody really knows what the hell a chief of staff does because there are so many of them and they do so many different things. There's a big difference between the 30,000 foot view of a chief of staff and the on the ground view, right? Like from a super high level, you say, oh yeah, you're attached to the executive team or to this one person and you help them. And then the day-to-day can be so variable based on what that looks like and the needs of the company are, whether they're, you know, your principal has a PA, blah, blah, blah. So the risk of not knowing what you're meant to be doing day to day and the risk of not structuring that and communicating that and setting the right precedent with every stakeholder is much, much higher. It's a risk in any job, but when your remit is already so broad, it can lead to either irrelevance or death by a thousand cuts. So to give a great example, right? If you come in at an early stage company and they've never had a management layer before, and you come in as a chief of staff and no one's worked with a chief of staff before, if you wanted to put on your trauma brain, your reactive sort of defensive brain, if I come in as head of product or chief marketing officer and here's this chief of staff guy and he doesn't tell me exactly what he's meant to be doing, I'm thinking, all I know is that he has the CEO and the COO's ear, but I don't really know what he's meant to be doing or how he's meant to help me or what he's going to execute on or what not to do. Is he going to be telling me what to do? Is he going to be policing me? If you don't set that precedent really early that you're meant to be a trusted partner to everyone in the organization, a confidant who is meant to be there both to be a bit of the iron fist and the velvet glove, but also to be the person who can solve problems before they arise. Setting those precedents is something and building that trust is something you can only do by example and over time. And it's a lot harder because you're building from scratch. It's not like going in and being, there are challenges to different roles, but if, let's say if you wanted to come in and be a head of sales, that's a well-known, relatively well-defined role in a number of companies. So if you come in as a head of sales, people will know how to interact with that and know how to integrate with that. As a chief of staff, you have to be an ambassador for the company, but you have to be your own ambassador at every single touch point, from the one-to-one that you have with a new joiner and onboarding, all the way through to the way you facilitate every strategy meeting. Because on top of that, again, I think one of the things that I realized as the role went on is if you don't set these precedents correctly and if you don't prime people correctly, it's easy to forget that it's a high visibility role and everyone in the organization is looking to you as an individual, not just as a representative of your role, but as a representative of the leadership team as well. So everything that you say reflects on them, everything they say reflects on you. And you kind of have to carry that weight around and be cognizant of it. It is a different kind of responsibility. It can be quite intangible, but it's important to know that it's there, right? Yeah. That you always have this link following you around of you know, okay, David, I know you and I trust you, but at the same time, because you are reporting to Erica, right? How much are you telling Erica and how much can I tell you, you know?
Yeah, totally. Okay. It's good to hear the pros and the cons and or both sides. And so then after you left Curio, and we talked about it a little bit before, but would love to hear about kind of that moment earlier this year or so when you were like, all right, transitioning and I'm going to do the portfolio life. Talk to us about how you had the comfort to know I'm going to be able to figure this out. I'm going to be able to take this skill set, this role, this experience that I had, and, you know that I can turn it into finding some clients and stuff.
How did you know? I want to flip the question back on you.
I wouldn't consider myself, a freelancer like you. I would consider myself a little more kind of full time, but with the podcast kind of, you know, just the personal project that I take seriously. So I'm not finding clients. I don't know what your engagements are like, but is that?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. If the question is, how did I have the confidence to know? I mean, I really didn't. You can never really know. I think that's the reality is that everyone faces imposter syndrome to some degree, except for the narcissists and the sociopaths. But I didn't exactly know. There was definitely an element, like many startup founders, I think what I do is not building a venture-backed startup, but there's a similarity in that you do jump off the cliff and build the plane on the way down to a certain extent. It's rare that you have this perfect jump off moment. But in my case, I guess there were a couple of things that helped. One was that I had done basically one piece of client work while I was still full-time. I was doing that part-time. It was light touch. In my case, it was doing some content writing. And that gave me one data point that said, hey, this is possible, right? And this is what it feels like. And I would always encourage anyone who's considering it to start there, because if you can make a smooth transition, that's the way to do it. It's a lot easier to swing from one vine to the next if you can see the next vine, or ideally if you can hold it in your hand. So I don't know if I had a full vine, but I had a twig. And then that was one of the big pull factors. There was also sort of a natural moment in the cycle where Curio was undergoing a lot of change. And I got to a milestone where I said, okay, if I came here to get through this, 18 or so month tour of duty, to go from that early Series A moment to implementing and setting up all of the new ways of working that the leadership team was going to do to make sure the company's a good stead, I had a lot of confidence, frankly, because the people around me and the company had changed quite a lot and they were executing really, really well. And I had gotten good feedback for that. So it was somewhat of a natural moment to pause and reflect on whether or not I wanted to show up and commit for the next 18 month or so chapter. And ultimately, I was being pulled so hard towards writing and pulled so hard towards doing my own thing that I thought they'll be in good stead. I'm not going to be leaving anyone in the lurch if I do leave. I have this one client who's at least shown me that there is a way to get this done. And very importantly, I also got some coaching, and the coaching helped me to come up with a plan and literally to build up some of the self-belief to go out there and get it done. And then finally, I had a little bit, not much, but some cash in the bank as a cushion so that if I had a month of flying fallow, then, I wouldn't go broke. But the thing that I can say is that there's an element of not being fully confident that is essential to what I do, because it gives me hunger to go out and figure out what the next project's going to be. It's in some moments that's frightening. I think if you're not scared in what you're doing, you're probably not stretching enough. So it was good to have a little bit of that fear. But more often than not, I just try to flip it on its head and say, no, it's not, I must find a client to close for 3 months from now. It's, oh, hang on a second. After these projects wrap up, I'm 80% free in 3 months. What do I want to do? I get to choose what I do next. And always trying to flip that responsibility into an opportunity mindset, because that's typically where I do my best work and where I'm the happiest.
I love that. That's amazing. Flipping into the opportunity mindset. And so you mentioned some of the content work, but what do you think about, or how do you see the kind of fractional chief of staff landscape? Is there, you know, you mentioned how you see the role sometimes as an 18-month role, but, you know, are you seeing, or, you know, does it, maybe it's, there's not postings for it, but like, you know, in talking to founders or other executives, like, are you in this moment or so, are you seeing, you know, kind of 3 months, 6 months, or, hey, a month with an asterisk, like there's a little bit more room here. If, you know, this, I can scope out a month, but like, we'll see where things go after that. Or, you know, or do you, yeah. How do you kind of see, that kind of fractional chief of staff generalist type of, marketplace these days?
So here's the secret. Almost no one is hiring for fractional chiefs of staff. And very few companies are hiring for fractional leaders, in the sense that when I say fractional, I'm thinking, you know, a day or 2 days a week, something less than full time. What's much more common is interim X, interim chief of staff, interim CXO, interim head of growth, interim strategy manager, or project based. I need a mercenary who's going to come and deliver this project. Any fractional leader that I've spoken to so far has become a fractional leader because they started by doing a small project in one of those two ways and built up enough trust and relationship that their client came back and said, oh, hey, you know what? Why don't you just come on as a fractional leader? And the reason for that is, it's particularly if you're in the startup space, most startup founders will have some kind of network of advisors, whether that's through NEDs or just through friends of theirs who have experience, or through angels that they're close with. And those people in the very beginning are almost like, you know, maybe they'll give you a couple of hours a month because they have skin in the game or just because they like you. But after that, the vast majority want someone who's going to be there 5 days a week, who can push hard, who can get in the hours, and particularly for a chief of staff role where like you're stuck in, you're operational, right? And the temptation, even with my projects today, is that it's like always tempting to like dig your fingers in deeper when that's maybe not what you want or what the client needs. So there's a mismatch in the market where there's a lot of people who want to be fractional chiefs of staff, but there's actually not, like, there's no roles being advertised for it. So if you want to be a fractional chief of staff, number one, and I learned this pretty quick, probably don't talk about it like a fractional chief of staff. I'll use it in this community because it is a precise term and it is probably the best label once you're on the inside and kind of behind the curtain. But the best thing you can do is go for those interim roles or project-based roles and try to build up a relationship. And if there's good vibes all around and you're delivering value and they're happy and you're happy, then maybe there's an opportunity there. Plus, my selling style is like very, very laid back, in the sense that I'm very much demand driven, which I think is, you know, it's served me well so far, touch wood. But it's not very pushy. And that means that I don't talk. I would rather in any conversation have the client bring up the word, hey, why don't we have you come on as a fractional chief of staff before I kind of raise it. And if we wanted to go more into how to get to that fractional point, basically all I can say is, any advice to someone is, if you're a chief of staff, just find a deliverable or like 3 to 5 deliverables that you can produce and try to sell that in like a day rate or fixed fee project based way, and start small. What you really want to do is almost think of it as like a trial for the job. With a job, you go into an interview, maybe it's a couple hours of a challenge, and then they give you a full-time offer or not. When you go portfolio, there's a much more gradual stepping, sort of sliding scale there. And so the easiest way in is to say, you know what? Hey, David, you said that you need someone to make you a pitch deck. Cool. I'll make you this pitch deck in the next 2 weeks. It's going to cost you, you know, X pounds. Fine. If you're happy with it, we'll see from there. In the process of making that pitch deck, we're talking about strategy. We're talking about team. I've probably interacted with your CPO and maybe an investor or two on your cap table. So I've got a couple of relationships. Make those people happy. Do good work. Push your strategic thinking. And if you, David, are happy and think, hey, you know what, Simon actually pushed me somewhere, the next time that you need a random piece of analysis done, hopefully I'm the guy at the top of your radar. And then you ask me 2 or 3 times and you realize, hey, you know what, it's actually just better if we get you in a retainer as a fractional capacity, because I'm sick of, you know, reading your proposal and like having the commercials get in the way of the work. That's the kind of slowly way to get there. And that's not just my experience so far, but that's what I've heard from a lot of other fractional leaders. So that said, this all goes out the window if you are, I don't know, Gustav Soderstrom and you're Daniel X CPTO at Spotify and you have like huge pedigree and everyone is just biting your hand off to get any part of your time. And you can come in and say, yeah, you know, I'll be your fractional CPO for some inordinate amount of money.
Got it. Okay. So I heard the branding of it is important. And then also focusing on a couple of deliverables and just kind of working on those and pitching those. And, you know, and in your case, it sounds like, you know, started with a small project while you were full-time. Anything else about the portfolio life that you want to share, Simon? Maybe the benefits?
Benefits. I knew going into it, well, let me take a couple steps back. I originally became a chief of staff because I had come out of management consulting and wanted to be a generalist and thought that I would like to be an entrepreneur of some sort one day. But I didn't want to just take all the risk on all at once. So I went to a Series B scale up and then a Series A startup and kind of progressed in the chief of staff ranks. And then after a few years in that game, I realized that it wasn't the right time for me to be a venture-backed founder. That wasn't the set of trade-offs that I wanted to make. But in the process, I knew that I deeply valued autonomy and I wanted to build something of my own. So that just really clearly pointed me in the direction of going solo, really, really clearly. And I can say that if you value your autonomy that much, then there's nothing else like it, right? The autonomy of schedule, the autonomy of location, the freedom the freedom in a certain extent to choose what types of work you want to do. With much freedom comes much responsibility. And you do have to take on the whole responsibility of being your entire back office. In my case, I'm a generalist. I love that. I found out that I love doing the BD, doing the selling, going out and having to, in sort of air quotes, network with people, which for me is just an excuse to say, hey, you know what? Now I run my own P&L and I can give myself a small budget to get coffees and lunches with really cool people, right? Who do I want to go and chat to? So if you're willing to take the initiative and really take accountability for your own career, then I would strongly encourage you to do that. If that degree of unstructuredness is scary, then it's something to think twice about. Net, you know, I probably work a bit harder than I do now. But I feel a lot more fulfilled and a lot happier for it. And cash wise, everything is going in the right direction, which is like the important thing that we probably didn't talk much about here. So net, not turning back on it at all. Very happy about it. I had a friend say recently that I'm making myself unemployable, which is potentially something that I think I'm happy about at this phase.
I love that. And the newsletter, right? It sounds like just the newsletter is it'll just continue to keep building and you don't know what that'll turn into. And so there's probably like, you know, interesting opportunities that could just pop up from now till whenever.
Yeah, definitely. I think when, in my experience going freelance and solo in the very beginning, the first concern is, well, I just got to find enough work. So I'm just going to say yes to a bunch of stuff. I'm going to experiment with pricing. I'm going to try to build a pipeline. I'm going to try to forecast, blah, 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 blah. And it was somewhat similar with the newsletter, which was, you know, I have a general idea. I've made some tweaks and iterations and it has definitely evolved, you know, in the 21 or so issues that have gone out so far. But I'm quickly getting to a phase, which is a huge, you know, luxury. And I'm really happy to have reached where now I'm not, you know, I'm getting close to the point of having too much work. If anything, I probably do at the moment. And the newsletter in itself is picking up decent traction. So it's going to be, I'm going to have to go in chief of staff myself and take myself on an away day and go write my own 6-page board memo about strategic decisions and how to optimize for the next year. Because now is a matter of being really thoughtful about the kinds of projects that I do want to do and what that means in terms of my own vision, mission, and kind of ideal clients for the next year. So yeah, lots to build on. Again, the fun part is I get to be the kind of master of my own fate. I had a mentor who once said, you know, when it comes to building a business, you can either be rich or be king, right? If you want to be rich, then go raise a big round, go build a big team. You're going to get diluted. You're going to have, you know, a lot of people around you who are sharing that success, but you can probably build something way, way, way bigger. Or you can be king and you can just have complete control over everything. And you'll probably go a little bit more slowly, but you'll have the autonomy. So far I've opted for king. So yeah, I'll let your listeners psychoanalyze me for whatever that means.
And so when people want to follow up with King Simon, what's the best way to do that?
My friends will tell you that's actually Don Simon after the Juice Company. No, they can follow the newsletter at Technopoly, technopoly.substack.com. They can find me on LinkedIn or also on Twitter at _SimonRodriguez. Or I imagine if they reach out to you, you can pass on my contact details. I give you that blessing and that burden. But I would love to hear from anyone, honestly, even if you're just considering the role. I'm always happy to take 30 minutes on the phone, interesting collaborations and opportunities. Yeah, I don't make it too hard to find me.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
Hey, friend. Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Portfolio Career Podcast. Would love to hear what you learned and what you enjoyed. You can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, whatever is best for you. And as a reminder, I'm just one email away as well. This episode with timestamp notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. There you can subscribe to my newsletter called One Email Away, which includes the best insights from the podcast and friend-sourced opportunities. So excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Thank you so much.